Okay. Well, good afternoon, everyone. I think we'll get started. Jimena and I will introduce ourselves. My name's Steve Burns. I'm currently the head of legal affairs at the OECD Nuclear Energy Agency and for the last 6 weeks. So before that, I was a general counsel at the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Jimena, you want to just go ahead and introduce yourself, too? Or maybe.
Yes, hello, everybody. I'm Jimena Vasquez. I'm also from the NEA Legal Affairs, and I'm a senior legal advisor. And I've been with the agency for almost a year now. And before that, I was working with EDF on Chinese projects. That will be for me.
Okay. Well, I want to welcome you all to the legal session of for IRPA. This is the second time we've had one, and I actually was at the first one in Buenos Aires 4 years ago, where we talked, one of the subjects that we talked about was nuclear liability and compensation. And today we're going to focus on that exclusively because we have, the theme running through the conference in terms of the meaning of the TEPCO Fukushima Daiichi accident in various sectors. It certainly has an impact in terms of the legal sector and unfortunately, in a way, a real case study in terms of the application of compensation and liability laws and the response of the government in that context. Our presentation today, I should highlight, is much of the material here we have developed in cooperation with our Japanese colleagues, who unfortunately were not able to provide anyone to be with us today. But as part of one of our responsibilities at the Nuclear Energy Agency, we have a nuclear law committee, and the Japanese did an extraordinarily thorough presentation, which we're drawing on today at our last meeting, at which they presented the compensation scheme. And it really is extraordinary in terms of, I think, with the rapidity with which the Japanese government realized it needed to move through the processes and establish basically the framework to move forward with in compensation. In the compensation area, and you're going to see that today in terms of our presentation. We're going to divide it into about three different parts, and we'll take questions at the end. What I'm going to start off with is, about third of the presentation, talk a little bit in general terms about nuclear liability, the legal construct, with some reference to what's happened in Japan and how the Japanese are working through it, and then we'll give some more details on specifically with respect to the Japanese system later on. One thing I should also highlight is that in the legal affairs group in NEA, we're working on a special publication we hope is out this summer. We've been working closely with the Japanese delegation to NEA that will put out, basically combine or compile in one doc or one book, if you will, the various pieces of legislation and guidance the Japanese are using and some various articles explaining explaining the system and challenges that they've had doing this. This will be published in English, and as I say, I hope by about midsummer. So why are nuclear liability and compensation regimes important? One aspect is in terms of either fears or concerns about nuclear energy use from a fear of the potential damage that could be caused as a result of an accident at an installation, nuclear installation, or transport of material or other types of uses. And in the early days, what happened, and this is true, I think, for some of both the international conventions, but also some of the national legislation. I know, particularly for myself, coming from the United States, for the Price-Anderson Act in the United States, that really the compensation regimes had a couple policy objectives, basically assuring the public and potential victims, if you will, of damage that might be caused by a nuclear incident, that they be protected in terms of compensation for the damage or injury that they would suffer. On the other hand, particularly you see this emphasis in the early days, is that there's also an interest in terms of protecting the investor, supplier, the operator from potentially ruinous liability claims. And so it was with this base, these sort of competing principles in mind that basically some harmony is tried to be developed through both national and international, at the national and international levels in terms of the legal structures to respond for liability schemes. So in overall, what we say is that the liability and compensation regimes are meant to address exceptional situations, not the usual tort situation that you have, you know, like an auto accident or whatever, and not to, you know, to be facetious about it, but to the what is considered an extraordinary circumstance. And again, that's liability and compensation that may be from a nuclear incident, damage caused by a nuclear incident at an installation or during transport, and that are associated with those exceptional risks from nuclear activities, where the normal, it's viewed that the normal compensation and tort system might not be suitable or might not be adequate. And it's, again, liability and compensation for damage suffered by third parties. And it's not so much the operator itself. So again, the corollary point there is that national, international regimes usually do not address the damage that might not be that might be caused by radioactive sources, but which would not be considered to pose exceptional risks. And that would be probably normal isotopic use in, you know, any kind of industrial, commercial, other types of activities that aren't expressly covered by the liability regimes. I'll give an example in the United States. I think in the 1990s, there was one point some consideration whether the Price-Anderson coverage, which is really for nuclear reactors and some other facilities, would become extended to the normal isotopic use in medicine. And essentially, we had special panels, special legislation, and it was decided not. And that's generally the case, again, because it's felt that the normal tort system can deal with that. And that can be either the normal tort liability, there may be contractual, other types of legal principles that are involved. So generally, when you talk about compensation, these extraordinary regimes, you're really talking about, is there a nuclear incident? And if you just look up there, I won't read through it, it's that gives you a basic background of what a nuclear incident is. And again, that's usually from some sort of a nuclear installation we think of in here, and we're going to see the examples in Japan from, you know, the nuclear reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi site. Again, just in context, and this is, I think, has probably been repeated in a number of other presentations through in other parts of the conference. Again, we have an extraordinary natural event occurring at Fukushima on March 11th, 2011. With the massive earthquake and the tsunami, extraordinary loss of human life, those counted as missing and injured as well. And although we don't have any particular casualties from the nuclear accident itself, you do have a massive evacuation, and that's in large, as I understand it, is largely still in effect in a certain, I guess, the 20-kilometer zone near the plant itself. And those evacuees, in effect, they are victims here, and as we'll see come into the compensation scheme. Now again, if you sort of just the overview, if you think of general principles of nuclear liability, the basic principles you can see here is generally a strict liability. There is exclusive liability. Under the international conventions, there's legal channeling. The U.S. is sort of a little bit different. The U.S. has channeling, but uses essentially an economic channeling. There's a limited liability amount. These are, again, these are sort of the in the origins of what the schemes look like. Limited liability amount. There's a requirement that compels operators essentially to have financial security in a certain amount. And another principle is essentially liability is limited in time, is generally limited in time. So those have been sort of essential principles in the international scheme and in many national schemes. Now, again, I've talked about the international schemes, and we'll mention some of the other the conventions in a moment, but it's just as important to note as we discuss this, Japan itself is not a member of any of the international liability conventions. It's had potential consideration to adoption and ratification of them over the years, but it has not done so as yet. Nonetheless, if you looked at the Japanese legislation, it essentially conforms to these basic principles for a liability regime, and these are, we won't go in right now into the details of each of these acts, but if you look at in context or in combination, these statutes and the Japanese statutes sort of underscore this or incorporate those principles. Just as a refresher, these are the International Nuclear Liability Conventions. Some of them are under the auspices of the OECD, Nuclear Energy Agency, essentially the Paris Convention from the early 1960s, or from 1960, 1963, a Brussels Convention supplementing the Paris Convention. There are some other protocols which have not completely gone into effect as yet. But as you can see, with the Paris Convention in 1960, and then under the Vienna Convention in 1963, this is an early concern. This goes back to the sort of the framework I pose, this tension between compensating victims and not unduly burdening the industry with extravagant liability. It goes back to these early days. And again, the U.S. example, the Price-Anderson Act was about the same time, I think about 1958 or 59 in the U.S. So under the auspices of the IAEA, you have the 63 Vienna Convention. You have a protocol amending it in 1997. Then importantly, you have this joint protocol relating to the application of both the Vienna and the Paris Conventions. And remember, most of the member states on those conventions, not all, but most of them and many of them for them are in Europe. And then we have in 1997 a new convention on the Convention on Supplementary Compensation for Nuclear Damage. This one is not yet in force either. This is the one the U.S. has joined, partly because there's a grandfathering clause that sort of lets the U.S. Join this convention to get around this little argument the lawyers have between legal and economic channeling, but it's it allows that to come in. That allows the U.S. to join that convention. But again, it's not yet in force. Just to give you a picture, this gives you an idea of states with nuclear generating capacity who has or who is a member of what conventions. And again, if you're going to see some important important countries with nuclear programs who are not members, such as China, Canada, Japan, and Korea, it does not mean that they don't have nuclear compensation schemes, because as I noted with Japan, that there is national legislation. But one of the, I should mention here, when we talk about the IAEA action plan, and in terms of the portion that deals with legal framework, one of the issues or one of the points in the action plan is trying to move even further toward a global liability regime, given within the existing constructs and with the existing conventions and treaties as they are. Again, we talked generally about the basic principles, the strict liability meaning that the operator is liable without proving fault or negligence. And basically, what it is is the victim has to prove a causal link between the accident itself and the damage they suffer. So you're not involved what would otherwise be in many tort situations, this potentially heavy burden of proof in terms of causing, by what means was the damage that you say you suffered caused. Again, it's this notion of exclusive liability where all liabilities channel to the operator. That means the victims don't need to pursue the vendor or the pump maker or other entities. They can go through to the operator itself. And again, the liability limited in time, meaning that it's usually been 10 years from the date of the accident. You may have to filing period within which you have to file a claim. In Japan, you see here that the right of action is extinguished 20 years from the date of the tort or the accident. And you must file the claim within 3 years after the date you have knowledge of both the damage and the person liable there. And that's essentially against the operator. And the operator here is generally the licensee or some other recognized entity with control over the facility. Again, limited liability, that's a feature of the earlier schemes. That is something, as the notion being a more mature industry, if you will, that the notion of limited liability to some extent may be fading. In Japan is actually the notion of unlimited liability, but we don't probably have complete time to look at that here, but that maybe in some respects the unlimited nature of liability can be a nature of the relationship between, let's say, the corporate entity and the state and how that is structured. Again, the notion of compulsory financial security, you have to have, you may have to carry insurance, other types of financial security up to the liability amount you're required to do, and that's going to be different schemes. Here you can see in Japan, security is up to, 120 billion yen for nuclear power plants under their Compensation Act. And again, that's a definition of what the operator must carry. Now, the interesting thing in all this, and this, we know a little bit of something today, but it will be interesting as the cases carry out. Under the Japanese Compensation Act, the operator shall be liable except in case the damage is caused by a grave natural disaster of an exceptional character or by an insurrection. Well, we're not dealing with an insurrection here, but we think about the Fukushima, the great Eastern Japan earthquake and the ensuing tsunami in this context. You have this magnitude 9 earthquake followed by the tsunami. Should this provision apply? And that was one of the early issues for the Japanese. We won't spend a lot on this. This sort of shows how it sort of scores, if you will, against other great natural events or disasters in the area. Again, an extraordinary event. But this is some other things, if you're interested. If you look there at some of the original legislation, this goes back to the Japanese legislation in 1951, exoneration would not be triggered under that provision if the event, unless the event is a huge natural disaster beyond all expectations of humankind, or completely unimaginable situation. That was the legislative history or some of the legislative discussion for this provision. Now, the interesting thing is TEPCO has not requested the benefit of this exoneration clause. The government says it hasn't applied, but ultimately, and I think this is will be the something I think lawyers will be interested in watching over the next few years, is it's really the civil courts that can interpret this clause. So it'll be interesting to see whether anything more happens on it. But right now, under the circumstances as we understand them, that clause is not being invoked. You see there the event is not covered fully by private insurance. The indemnity part of the government was 120 billion yen. At that point, by November 2011, it had been completely drawn upon. Now, again, the scope of compensation, you can see there, again, under their act, it means any damage caused by the effects of the fission process of nuclear fuel or from radiation, but the damage suffered by the operator itself is excluded, which is a typical provision. Again, there has to be this causal link between the occurrence at the installation and the damage itself, and Jimena is going to go more into that. Where damage occurs in excess of that financial security under the Compensation Act, the government steps in and must give the operator as much aid as it is required to compensate for the damage, and as approved by the national legislature, by the Diet. And we'll go into that a little more later. Again, just a preview of what we're going to talk more about for resolving compensation claims, the victim can either file directly to the with the operator, can file before a reconciliation committee that's been set up, or before the civil courts. The Japanese set up an alternative dispute resolution center last September. To help the handling of thing. It's not mandatory, and you don't give up all your rights, as we understand it, by invoking it, invoking this process. But you can see that a number of cases and all have been filed with this resolution center. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. So that's, I mean, right now, at this point, I've tried to give you here sort of the overview of what nuclear liability schemes generally try to do, some context what the Japanese do, or what the Japanese scheme is, and we'll talk a little bit now more, and we'll get a little more into the compensation scheme in itself. Thanks.